This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, recovery teams in New Zealand are still being kept at bay because there is a growing risk of another eruption on White Island. Also, a New South Wales Liberal Environment Minister explicitly links worsening fire conditions and a changing climate, but has he convinced other political climate doubters? And we've been following a legal battle for a while for better housing in a Central Australian Indigenous community. Well, today it's gone to the Supreme Court. It's all about the definition of what's habitable.
Is there aircon in this room?
No, I gotta buy it for maybe $700-$800.
Does it get hot at night?
Oh, really, really? Just like hell in there. Yes, I've been sleeping on the kitchen floor for years, and I'm still here just because there's aircon in the kitchen.
Heartache compounded across the nation tonight. There's been confirmation that a mother and daughter and an Adelaide man, all missing since New Zealand's White Island volcano erupted on Monday, are among the dead. Julie Richards and her daughter Jessica are being remembered as adventure-loving thrill-seekers by distraught loved ones left behind. And the family of Gavin Dullow is reeling. They were told of his death late this afternoon. The anxious wait for news of those Australians still missing, feared lost, continues, with disaster identification teams having to wait until it's safe to get onto White Island. Meanwhile, Australia has sent skin and tissue donations to New Zealand burns units to try and save those who are clinging to life. Our report tonight is from Rhett Burney.
Gavin Dullow's family had been holding on to hope he'd be found alive after the White Island volcano disaster. But this afternoon, his elderly father, Brian, was given the worst of news.
I was lucky enough to spend the last 3 days of the last test match with him, which was only 2 days prior to when he left on the trip. So that is something I'll hold in my memory for a long time.
The 53-year-old Adelaide lawyer was on holiday with his wife Lisa and her 15-year-old daughter Zoe Hosking. They'd been exploring White Island when the volcano erupted on Monday. Authorities say they now believe Zoe was also killed, but that her body is still in the disaster zone.
Our heart breaks at the loss of Zoe at such a young age.
Lisa Dullow is in a coma and fighting for life in hospital. She has burns to up to 58% of her body. It's also been a day of heartbreak for loved ones of Brisbane woman Julie Richards and her daughter Jessica. New Zealand police confirmed their deaths this morning. Family friend John McKell.
With anybody, you obviously live in hope that it's not going to be your loved one's name that comes up. There's always that hope. But the hope was snuffed out this morning with the message from the New Zealand police.
Still missing a Sydney couple, Anthony and Christine Langford, their 15-year-old son Jesse and 17-year-old daughter Winona. Coffs Harbour couple Richard Elzer and Carla Matthews are also still unaccounted for, as well as 21-year-old Melbourne student Crystal Browett. 30 people are being treated for burns in New Zealand's overwhelmed health system. Dr. Ashley Bloomfield is the Director General of Health. He says the National Multiple Complex Burn Action Program has been activated.
This is the first time this has been activated in a unique situation where we have a number of very seriously injured people in our regional burns units around the country.
Dr. Stefan Poniatowski is the head of the donor tissue bank at the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine. He says help is on its way from Australia in the form of skin and tissue donations.
We had a call yesterday from the New Zealand Blood Service, who manage the skin stocks for the New Zealand burns units, and requesting an urgent delivery of skin. We sent from here 10,000 square centimetres from Melbourne.
Dr. Poniatowski says burns specialists prefer to use the victim's own tissue for skin grafts, but almost all of those injured in the White Island disaster have suffered burns to more than 50% of their bodies, making donor skin grafts the only viable treatment.
In those cases, skin allograft is undoubtedly life-saving, and without those allografts, the patients are really going to struggle. And also over time, we also find that where we've used skin allograft on these patients, the scarring is much more reduced than would be with any other alternatives.
Australia expects to bring home up to 10 injured patients for specialist burns care in Sydney and Melbourne, starting within 24 hours. A C-130 Hercules departed RAF Base Richmond and two C-17 Globemasters departed RAF Base Amberley to Christchurch with a team of specialist aircrew and medical equipment on board this afternoon. And while efforts to save the severely injured continue, retrieving the bodies of up to 8 people killed on White Island is proving difficult. New Zealand's Civil Defence Emergency Management Director, Sarah Stewart-Black.
This is an utterly tragic situation. We all agree that retrieving bodies of the deceased from the island is an absolute imperative. Every day that passes with those bodies unrecovered is a day of anguish for their loved ones who have been affected. We recognise this and we're doing everything we can.
New Zealand police have conducted 4 flyovers of White Island this morning using a drone, but Graham Leonard from GNS Science says it's still too dangerous for recovery experts to get on the ground.
This is highly wind varying, but at times it will be challenging for breathing, seeing or walking on the island, and at other times clear. There is the risk of another eruption, like Monday's eruption, while on the island.
And he says that risk has increased over the past 24 hours. Professor David Ranson, also from the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine, specialises in disaster victim identification.
It's challenging from the point of view of the science that needs to be done and the medicine that needs to be done, and also emotionally challenging for those people facing, obviously, people who have been very seriously injured.
He says even when it is safe for the bodies to be retrieved, identifying them will be a challenging task.
The work of disaster victim identification teams is very, very focused on the needs of families and returning deceased individuals to their loved ones as soon as possible.
Professor David Ranson from the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine. Rhett Burney, our reporter. Well, in the tumultuous politics of the United States, there is now a formal call for the removal of President Trump from office, but the president himself is calling it weak. Impeachment light, he says. House Democrats have unveiled 2 articles of impeachment which claim the president ignored and injured the interests of the nation when he asked the government of Ukraine for assistance in next year's election. A vote on the president's impeachment could be held as early as next week, though it is still fiercely opposed by Republicans. The president used a rally in Pennsylvania to deliver his verdict. Watching the events, our reporter Rachel Mealy.
It's not every day articles of impeachment against a sitting president are announced, but this president is undeterred.
Well, thank you to Vice President Pence. Thank you, Mike. And hello, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
In front of a fawning crowd at a rally in Pennsylvania, President Trump suggests US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and her fellow Democrats have made a tactical error.
They're embarrassed by the impeachment, and our poll numbers have gone through the roof because of her stupid impeachment.
On the same day they announced their intention to impeach the president, the Democrats also handed President Trump a win by approving a trade deal he brokered with Mexico and Canada, known as the USMCA. President Trump says approving the trade deal was intended to overshadow the impeachment proceedings.
After years of waiting, many, many years, many, many decades, they've been looking for this. And then we got it done, and we've been waiting for a long time for Nancy Pelosi to announce USMCA. And she did it on the same day that they announced that they are going to impeach the 45th president of the United States, and your favorite president, I think.
Brendan O'Connor is an associate professor in American politics at the University of Sydney.
Trump is using this to argue that she's trying to cover up what is a weak case, but I think it's more just, you know, the timing of these things. I think we won't, you know, be talking about this coincidence in 2 weeks' time or a week's time when Trump is probably impeached by the House of Representatives.
The charges outlined in the articles of impeachment focus on President Trump's dealings with Ukraine's president and his attempts to smear his political rival Joe Biden. They don't relate to the 2016 presidential election or any assertion that President Trump condoned Russian interference. Professor O'Connor says the Democrats have homed in on the clearest case against the president.
There's all sorts of things that you could push for Trump as an abuse of power, as an obstruction of justice, but many of them are more convoluted than the simple case that he rings up the Ukrainian leader and says, look, you need to investigate Joe Biden before you can visit the White House or get military aid, and then this obstruction of Congress's investigation. Those are pretty two fairly simple things to explain.
Outside today's rally in Pennsylvania, fans of President Trump repeated his familiar defense that the impeachment is a witch hunt.
Nobody's perfect, and he hasn't been without mistakes, but he certainly has done more things right than wrong.
I'm very upset today. I'm glad I'm here, but I think it's so hard because, you know, he's done such a great job, and this is the way that he's being treated. It's very upsetting to me.
A Trump supporter on her way into that rally in Pennsylvania, Rachel Mealy with our report. Well, the scientists are in near complete agreement, but Australia's politicians still are not. The New South Wales Environment Minister, Matt Keane, broke ranks with his fellow Liberals yesterday and unambiguously linked the current bushfires in the eastern states with climate change. There's been little support from his federal colleagues, though one Liberal backbencher has flagged that voters are increasingly looking for action. And as that bickering proceeds, firefighters, exhausted from weeks of firefighting on the East Coast, are increasingly frustrated by what they hear from Canberra. Here's our reporter, David Sparks.
Critics and supporters have been lining up to have their say on the New South Wales Environment Minister, Matt Keane, who has, in no uncertain terms, linked the bushfires with climate change. Some of his coalition colleagues appeared less than impressed, including the Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack.
Well, indeed, Matt Keane has made those comments. He's not in my party. He's a member of the Liberal Party. I'm a member of the National Party. In fact, I'm the leader of the National Party.
And on the question of what's driving these bushfires?
Most of these fires have been caused by little lucifers running around with matches and fire starters and creating havoc.
But Matt Keane is not backing down. Today he went on commercial radio station 2GB and delivered this message to his fellow coalition MPs.
If those colleagues are scientists, then I'm very happy to listen to their opinion. But the reality is the scientists and the experts who are best placed to give us advice on these matters are saying that we need to take steps to adapt to our changing environment and also to mitigate the impact of our carbon emissions.
The closest Matt Keane came to receiving support from a frontbencher in the Morrison government was from Federal Environment Minister Susan Lee, who, unlike Mr McCormack, says there is a link.
Climate change increases the risk and intensity of bushfires. That's what climate scientists have told me, and I completely agree with them.
But one Liberal backbencher, the member for Wentworth, Dave Sharma, was much stronger in his support for Matt Keane's comments.
Yeah, look, I saw what Matt Keane said and I heard him interviewed this morning, and I agree by and large with what he says. There's no doubt that climate change is increasing the frequency and severity of extreme weather events like bushfires. It's increasing the frequency and severity of events like droughts. And the fires we're experiencing right now in New South Wales are multifactorial. There's a number of things behind them, but climate change is certainly playing a part.
And Dave Sharma acknowledges voters are increasingly anxious about climate change.
Look, I think there's no doubt that, you know, climate change is and continues to be an important issue for voters in my electorate and in large parts of Australia. And I think, you know, seeing firsthand increased frequency and severity of weather events like this and seeing the direct impact on quality of life and things obviously only elevates that issue as one of importance to them.
While Mr Keane was unambiguous in his attack on people who refused to acknowledge the link between these fires and climate change, he was unwilling to criticise the Commonwealth's policies to reduce emissions. He says governments here and around the world need to do more, and he talked up the New South Wales government's push to reduce emissions. Meanwhile, as politicians argue, firefighters in New South Wales continue their battle. Hardin Rural Fire Service Captain Peter Holding is a member of the group Farmers for Climate Action, and he fears fire crews won't be able to keep up the pace over the coming summer.
I just am very concerned that the volunteers are going to run out of
ability to continue this level of task. Many of the volunteers have got jobs and they're away from them for weeks on end. There's got to be some leadership on this, and they've got to stand up and they've got to accept that this is being influenced by climate change, as the drought is.
Rural Fire Service Captain Peter Holding, David Sparks, our reporter. You're listening to PM. We're on the radio. We are also on the ABC Listen app, and you can subscribe to the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Now, have you heard the term black cladding? It's being used to refer to companies that claim Indigenous ownership to fraudulently claim hundreds of millions of dollars in government projects. Indigenous business owners are exasperated.
It's a shame it happens. And unfortunately, I think that every time that you come up with a solution for the problem, someone's going to be sneaky enough to try and weave their way in and find another way in. I don't know how you chop the snake's head off and that's it.
One of Myanmar's leading intellectuals says it is urgent that the world protect the nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees languishing in Bangladesh, as initial hearings in a genocide case over Myanmar's expulsion of the Muslim minority group proceed in The Hague this week. Strikingly, the woman once lauded as an icon of democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi, is sitting grim-faced leading Myanmar's defence team in the court. She's effectively the country's prime minister in a military-dominated government, and she's ready to defend the army, with which she has a complex relationship. Opening addresses laid out starkly an array of atrocities in breach, claimants say, of the Genocide Convention that dates from after the Nazi attempt to exterminate the Jews in World War II. It'll be a long time until this matter is adjudicated, but does Myanmar have a legitimate case that it saw a militant threat when it launched its campaign against the Rohingya? Thant Minh U is a prolific author on Myanmar. His latest book is The Hidden History of Burma. He's a former UN diplomat and the grandson of former UN Secretary General U Thant. We spoke earlier.
If you start the story in 2016, around the time that Aung San Suu Kyi had appointed Kofi Annan to head a commission to look into the situation in Rakhine and about the Rohingya, you have this emergence of this new militant group, ARSA, which did attack government security forces. And over the following months in early 2017, had also killed a number of civilians as well. And I remember being in Rangoon at that time, and there was a real paranoia about this new group and an allegation that they were linked in turn to international Islamist or jihadi groups as well. So there was a genuine fear. There was a demand by ordinary people and the public and political parties for the army to take tough action against them. And so when they attacked police posts in August of 2017 and then allegedly killed large numbers of civilians, the public was all on side of a tough army crackdown. Now, if you take the camera kind of out and look at the wider picture, I mean, all of that, of course, comes after decades of discrimination against Rohingya people, but also years of preceding violence in which hundreds of thousands, including over 100,000 Muslims in Rakhine State had been displaced.
Do you think that the Myanmar government, the military, used that context you've just described to set their mind to take out the Rohingya, if you like?
I mean, look, the issue of genocide is now a legal determination. There is overwhelming evidence that there were extrajudicial executions. What the intent of that was, whether there was an attempt to or an intent to use that militant group's actions as an excuse to wipe out in whole or in part this particular ethnic group, push out 700,000 people across the border, knowing that they may never be able to come back. I suppose that's a question that may be difficult to prove because the intent is still not clear. I think some people will say it is clear that this was the objective all along, but I'm not sure that case is as ironclad as people might think.
Let's talk a bit about Aung San Suu Kyi. I mean, this woman who was so lauded for so long as a democracy icon and has now disappointed so many of those who supported her. How do you see her?
I think, you know, we go back to that period in the 1990s and 2000s, and there was increasing repression. She herself was very isolated. And so in a way, it was understandable that people kind of raised her up as an icon. But I think it's important to remember that that's what she was at that time. She was an icon to the West. So, you know, I think in the 2000s, with the political transition that happened, she could have gone in many different directions. But I think at heart, she has always been a Burmese nationalist. And I think that nationalist impulse is something that drives her. And the legacy of her father as the creator of this army and her desire for reconciliation with this army.
I mean, we're talking about your country, a country you have thought about deeply, written about a lot. How do you feel watching this process unfold?
No, I think it's absolutely tragic, because at a time when, you know, Burma, Myanmar was just coming out of decades of international isolation, just beginning to try to build sort of incipient democratic institutions, a whole young generation getting used to being part of a more open political environment, to have this being the defining issue, I think is awful for the 700,000-800,000 plus refugees. It's awful for the Muslim and other communities left behind in Rakhine. It's awful for prospects for sustainable development going forward and all these other priorities that we have. And I really do think that there's a direct connection here between the exploding levels of wealth inequality and economic anxiety and the kind of desire by people to mobilize around tribal, ethnic, racial identities.
And just finally, what about justice for the Rohingya? What chance do you think?
I think justice is incredibly important, but these international processes are bound to take years, and we just don't know where they're going to lead. I think in the meantime, the focus actually needs to be on the protection of vulnerable people now, both in terms of people who are in the refugee camps, including the children, and nearly half the population of refugees are kids. And then you have very vulnerable populations left inside the country. I mean, it's both Rohingya, it's other Muslim communities, it's non-Muslim communities as well. One story that's almost never told is that there's a whole new insurgency in Rakhine, the Arakan Army, which is a Buddhist Arakanese insurgency. And that has led to intense fighting and the displacement of another 100,000 people.
Thantmint Ooh, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Author Thantmint Ooh, and he was on the line from Yangon. A lot more on Myanmar's complex story in a longer version of that interview. You can find it at the PM webpage. Well, residents of the Central Australian community of Santa Teresa have gone to the NT Supreme Court today, continuing their battle for decent housing. The residents have already won a class action. That was back in February when the NT Civil Tribunal found that the Northern Territory government was failing to maintain their public housing. But that, they say, did not go far enough, and that's the basis for their appeal in the Supreme Court today. Oliver Gordon takes up the story.
In 2018, the small desert community of Santa Teresa was named the territory's tidiest town. But now, on a 42-degree day, the neat streets and manicured gardens of this former Catholic mission are empty, and residents like Annie Young are huddled inside, around their air conditioners.
We had to buy our own split system up there. That cost about $700, because we haven't got a Swampy in the house.
Swampies are powerful air conditioners that cool large spaces, and many of the Santa Teresa residents have been asking their landlords, the NT government, for them to be installed in their houses for many years. As a member of the town's housing reference group, Annie Young played a key role in the class action against the NT government, which found it was not meeting its obligations as landlord to some people in her community. The class action led to people being reimbursed after paying rent for houses that had unlockable doors, leaking showers, blocked toilets, and no air conditioning. But 10 months on, as Annie Young shows me around where she lives, she says there's still a long way to go.
This room is really small.
And this is your room?
Yep, with my 9-year-old grandson.
And is there aircon in this room?
No, I gotta buy it, which I can't afford. I'm just on Centrelink payment.
Does it get hot at night?
Oh, really, really. It's just like hell in there.
Are you able to sleep?
No, not at all. That's why I still sleep on the kitchen floor. Yes, I've been sleeping on the kitchen floor for years, and I'm still here, just because there's aircon in the kitchen.
Lawyer Dan Kelly is representing the people of Santa Teresa in the NT Supreme Court and says situations like this are unacceptable.
You simply can't live in a remote community in Central Australia without an air conditioner in December and have the premises be habitable without access to those sort of facilities.
The solicitor from the group Australian Lawyers for Remote Aboriginal Rights says his client's appeal centres around the legal definition of the word habitable. He will argue that this word, when applied to houses in Santa Teresa, should mean comfortable and humane, not just safe.
We are relying on case law, particularly case law from the United Kingdom, where that is an accepted definition of the term habitable. We don't think it's in any way controversial. That's the position we'll be putting to the court.
If the court rules in favour of the residents of Santa Teresa, it could set a precedent for other remote communities around the Northern Territory. That's why Walter Shaw of the newly formed group Aboriginal Housing NT is watching proceedings closely.
Look, I think it is a landmark case, Oliver, you know, and I take my hat off to the residents of Santa Teresa. If it's a win-win for Santa Teresa, it's a win-win throughout the whole of the Northern Territory with regard to appropriating, you know, a more standardised way of living for Aboriginal people.
In a statement, the NT Department of Housing says it doesn't add air conditioners to existing homes. Tenants can apply for permission to add them at their own expense. It says 93 of the 99 homes at Santa Teresa have been upgraded in the last 3 years, and 5 new homes have been built, with another 2 planned.
Oliver Gordon with that report. There's evidence that the federal government's policy to turbocharge Indigenous businesses is being exploited by non-Indigenous Australians. It's known as black cladding, and an independent report shows non-Indigenous companies are inflating their Indigenous shareholder base or attempting to misrepresent themselves as Aboriginal businesses in a bid to win contracts. PM has also been told the private sector is turning its back on many Indigenous businesses, even after they've proved their mettle by completing multi-million dollar contracts through the government's Indigenous procurement policy. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
Pacific Services CEO Troy Ruglis knows a thing or two about taking on large infrastructure projects. The Wiradjuri man and his construction company took on the task of redesigning and building a new wharf at Sydney's Garden Island Navy Base.
But we give them 6 options on what to do with the wharf because it was so old. And the last option was the $213 million option where it was a full reconstruction. So they had to take into consideration, you know, maintenance on the wharf. If we just patched it up, it'd cost more over the years. So this was the option that they went with.
Some of the projects funded through the government scheme are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and there's intense interest in securing them. But some non-Indigenous businesses are now misrepresenting themselves to get over the line. This can take the form of establishing shadow businesses with Indigenous owners.
It's a shame it happens. And unfortunately, I think that every time that you come up with a solution for the problem, someone's going to be sneaky enough to try and weave their way in and find another way in. I don't know how you chop the snake's head off and that's it.
The government has indicated that from the 1st of July next year, it'll set targets for Indigenous participation in high-value contracts. Indigenous Business Australia, a government agency created to assist Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, says that's a good start. Stella DeCoste is the Director of Business Solutions at the agency.
Well, I think that sector resources such as IBA or Supply Nation and a lot of states and territories have their own mechanisms to measure, in particular, the shareholding structures of a business or an organisation that are vying for contracts as well. And I think it's a work in progress. It's come a significant way, I think, in the last 4 years.
Despite this, consulting firm Deloitte has found the implementation of the IPP has had an overall positive effect on Indigenous business. The report says Indigenous enterprise is rapidly becoming, quote, big business in Australia. There are between 12 and 16,000 Indigenous-owned businesses, which collectively generate more than $1 billion per year, with revenues increasing on average by 12.5% a year. The report suggests Indigenous procurement policies in both the public and private sectors are accelerating growth. Troy Ruglis agrees government projects have helped shift his business up a few gears, but he isn't so positive about the private sector's work with Indigenous businesses.
That's what I find offensive, that we're not even looked at when we can do a $213 million job with defence. And we can't even get an opportunity to tender in the corporate sector.
Indigenous Business Australia's Stella DeCoste says the private sector needs to make a greater effort.
And being present, actually having industry briefing sessions, I think, with businesses really helps. Spending time with businesses to understand their internal structures, to know that they're actually set up and the systems are in place to manage these considerable contracts as well.
The government says it'll continue to work with Indigenous businesses, particularly in rural and remote areas, by linking Indigenous businesses with support services so they can get the most out of the policy.
David Taylor with that report. And that is PM for this Wednesday. Now, tomorrow, the cricket is on your analogue transmitters. We hope to bring you PM in the lunch break just after 6 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time. But we are still loud and clear and live on digital radio and streaming on the ABC Listen app at the usual time. Or you can catch us on PM's webpage, or indeed you can enjoy PM as a podcast. Maybe take the chance to subscribe if you haven't already. already. Tomorrow morning, Kim Landers brings you AM, and then at lunchtime, Eleanor Hall will be along with The World Today. I'm Linda Mottram. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow evening. In the meantime, enjoy the radio, and ABC News will keep you up to date. Good night.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
We're less than 2 weeks into the Australian summer, but it already feels like it's been a lot longer than that.
All anyone can talk about right now is the bushfire crisis and the air quality. So today on The Signal, what does the data say about the exact difference between your summers, the summers your parents used to have, and the next 20 to come?
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.